welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I'm kind of fascinated by the whole social role of the sex expert. I think the whole sex expert thing is pretty fascinating, because watching how they work, you can get a sense kind of at an angle of some of the continued issues that human beings face in terms of modern humans anyway, in terms of trying to understand sexuality and trying to, quote-unquote, fit it into the rest of our lives, particularly in terms of modern relationships and the enormous amount of strife and suffering so many people seem to go through. And then they turn to this figure who's the sort of sex expert and who has like a map or a typology of relationships, why things go wrong and what planets the different genders are from, et cetera, et cetera. And I was watching one recently on TED by Esther Perel. And it was quite good. She was very appealing. She'd done a lot of sociological homework, had gone around to 20-odd countries comparing different ways of being in love and being married and being sexual and trying to come up with some ways of understanding basically the you know, ongoing problem numero uno for so many people in our modern world, which is the disaggregation, one might say, of monogamous love commitment and eroticism. And so she, the first half of her talk, she laid out this excellent description of the problem of how the very desires and structures that satisfy our needs for monogamous commitment, you know, comfort and a safe structure, the known, completely undermine what seem to be pretty persistent aspects of our erotic life, which is a search for adventure, for the naughty, for what's unknown, for the dangerous. And then she went on and laid out a number of these kind of binaries, and talking about, you know, how profound the issues are for so many people. And then you're like, okay, I'm waiting for the punch, right? This is where the sex expert comes in and kind of offers a solution to the problem. And she, to her credit, didn't offer a, you know, some grand new typology, and really just made kind of she noticed what seemed to work for long-term couples who were still had active sex lives. What were the factors that made them be able to, you know, keep their juicy lives going. And, you know, so I couldn't tell whether she kind of wanted you to go buy the book or whether she just recognized there wasn't so much to say, but I just started reflecting on the whole problem of that structure, where there's an excellent description with gripping detail that we can all, you know, elaborate in our own lives and knowing people in our lives of the problem, and then this sort of move towards some kind of solution. And it's often pretty unsatisfying. And I compare that with a TED Talk I just watched this morning from our guest today, Christopher Ryan. And he was talking about, you know, very similar issues. And but it really, his talk, other than having better jokes, he really just kind of laid out the problem. And that's that problem is what we're going to be talking about today on the show, which is why, as the subtitle of the Sexathon goes, why we stray, and what it means for modern relationships. And it's a book he wrote with his wife, Casilda Jeta. And Maja will not be joining us today. She's off being an astrologer. And so with that, we'll bring on our guest. Christopher, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Yeah. So I know we try to get this conversation going the other day. I had a few flubs, and I'm still going to start out in the same way, because I do think it's an interesting story. What it was that was either going on in the world, going on in your life, that first made you think about doing a project based on this sort of critique of a lot of the conventional ways in which we've come to think about the reasons for monogamy and what sort of anthropological and other factors go into that question. So there must have been something that was, you know, catching in your own life, in your mind, in your interests that drew you into this field.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated in trying to distinguish the human from the cultural, you know, to try to figure out what experiences or what aspects of our experience is species-wide versus just, you know, American 20th century kind of thing. And so I've always looked at things in those terms, and I guess probably the trigger for this particular line of thinking was the Clinton-Lewinsky situation. And, you know, I was thinking about that and saying, well, if men have sort of held all the levers of power throughout recorded history, as seems to be pretty much agreed upon, men, you know, have had the military power and economic and even just basic physical strength. How is it that they designed a world in which the most powerful man in the world is getting humiliated publicly for doing something that most men would do if given that opportunity? And it just didn't make sense to me. And at that time, a book fell into my hands called The Moral Animal by Robert Wright, which is a beautifully written book that sort of, it's like an introduction to evolutionary psychology and the major thinkers in evolutionary psychology. And I read that, this is the mid-90s, I guess, and it just seemed to make so much sense to me. I was really excited by it, and I started telling people around me about these theories that men have always traded protection and status and so on to women in exchange for sexual fidelity, so they would know that the kids, you know, were their kids and they weren't investing in someone else's kids. And it's this whole economic model of human sexual evolution. And luckily at that time I was surrounded by really smart, sexually self-aware women. I was in San Francisco, and I was working in a nonprofit called Women in Community Service, and it was 50 women and one other guy and me. And so there were women everywhere in my life, and I was living with a woman who was really smart, and she had lots of friends. But it seemed like men, when I talked to men about this, they thought, yeah, yeah, that's perfect, makes sense. But when I talked to these women, I kept getting the response that, well, that's a very phallocentric, you know, a Victorian male vision of sexuality. That's not how we experience sexuality. So, okay, I went back and started looking at the original research that underlies this argument. And lo and behold, I found all sorts of really interesting stuff, like bonobos. I didn't know anything about bonobos. Bonobos completely subvert that narrative of human sexual evolution.
Yeah, I want to stay with that just for a little bit more, just to emphasize again just how widespread it is. I mean, anybody who's read any of the kind of, you know, sexpert books that I was talking about, or have, you know, newspaper accounts, or other sorts, or books like The Moral Animal, which is a great book, and that was also my introduction to a lot of evolution, the bulk of evolutionary psychology, and I can tell in some ways the book you wrote, Sex at Dawn, emulates it in the way in which it's both, you know, very informed by research and very, you know, intellectually coherent, but it's also accessible and engaging with that. So that's a good connection to make. But just, you know, how widespread and almost anxious that explanation is, you know, and it's a funny thing about reading evolutionary psychology because, you know, it's got this slippery edge. On the one hand, you're like, oh, great, finally, I can, like, relax and actually think about, you know, factual situations or very understandable situations that emerge from the basic realities of being animals, trying to survive, reproducing, you know, like, let's get down to, like, the really basic elements and see all these things that we think of as being purely cultural actually have these coherent sort of foundations, and it's like a relief. But then you're like, okay, that's great, and that can happen. Then you start going, whoa, wait, but there's actually a lot of accounts then they, sometimes they differ quite extraordinarily. And then you see the way in which they can hide cultural ideas in the guise of these, like, very coherent scientific explanations. And it seems to me that what you did with Sex at Dawn is you found one of the most glaring in the usual repertoire of evolutionary psychology. Men, you know, monogamy exists because men trade their goods and services for the knowledge of their paternity and da 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 da. And you were like, huh, maybe that's not quite it. So you go up and talk about the bonobos and how they started to undermine that standard narrative for you.
Well, sure. I mean, everybody, as you say, everybody in the popular press refers to chimpanzees when they're talking about the primate origins of anything, right? Whether it's our sexuality or violence or, you know, male dominance, political orders, and, you know, chimps are the go-to reference in primatology, which is fine because the fact is that chimps are very closely related to human beings. But the problem is that they don't generally mention bonobos. And bonobos are equally closely related to human beings. I often say our relationship with chimps and bonobos is as if I have twin brothers. They're more closely related to each other than to anyone else, but after each other, I'm the next closest relation to both of them. And they're equally related to me. So any account of primate origins really has to include both chimps and bonobos. Now, chimps are nasty, sometimes nasty, male-dominated, very hierarchical, often violent. So they fit into this Hobbesian vision of the world in which, you know, we're just barely controlling our nasty impulses. But bonobos are female-dominated, highly sexualized, and in 50 years of observation in the wild and in captivity, no bonobo has ever been seen to kill or rape another bonobo. They're very relaxed.
One question before we take this a little bit farther, just a general one, is that when I grew up, I never heard the name bonobo.
Right.
I mean, even though I knew about orangutans and whatever, I was just, you know, a kid who was interested in primates. But I never even heard about them. And is that because they are very, like, small and localized in comparison to chimps? Or is it really just that something disturbs people about the bonobo, so they would just not include it? Even, leaving aside the whole issue of just sexuality, just as, like, indicating that in the world of primates there are this other group called, bonobos.
Yeah, I think it's mostly the latter. I mean, it to be fair, bonobos are isolated in a very difficult part of the Congo, whereas chimps are in several different parts of Africa that are more accessible for researchers. So there is that. But they've been in captivity since World War II, at least. There have been troops of bonobos in various parts of the world. So they've been accessible for study in captivity by pretty much anyone, any grad student. And there, as I say, for about 50 years, people have been studying them both in the wild and in captivity. The main reason they're not better known is that they're embarrassing. Franz de Waal tells a story. He's a great primatologist, a Dutch primatologist who's done great work bringing them into mainstream awareness. And he told a story about how he consulted with an American company. I don't remember which network it was, but they wanted to do a story on bonobos, and they sent a film crew to Congo. And, you know, he met them there and was helping set everything up. And they went out and started filming them. And the bonobos are having sex several times per hour, right? And after shooting for a day or two, the producer said, we're not going to be able to use this. These things are constantly having sex. I can't shoot them. And Franz was like, well, why can't you use it? This is their behavior. You know, this is a nature program. So it embarrasses people that they're so sexual, and I think it sort of it touches a nerve in human beings that we're so repressed about our sexuality. So something like that suggests this angle on our sexuality is hard for people to take. But the truth is, we are a highly sexual species. There's just no way to deny that.
Yeah, I mean, I want to stay with that great story just for a second to think about a little bit, because, you know, and I understand why you said how you interpret the way you did, that we're so repressed about our sexuality. But, of course, it's more complicated and profoundly contradictory than that, where on the one hand, there is repression, there is discomfort, there is a lack of kind of embrace of just our sort of, you know, give basic or our sexual drive, and yet we're obviously obsessed with sexuality. It's everywhere. It's in advertisement. It's getting weirder and weirder. I mean, I swear, I think, you know, if someone was transported even from like 20 years ago, let alone 30 or 40 years ago, into our current media environment, they would be freaked out by the degree of, you know, eroticism, teenage eroticism,
just oh, yeah,
the intensity of the stuff that we see. So it's not just about that we're repressed, like we don't, like in a Victorian sense, we don't want to see it, we don't want to acknowledge it. So it's almost like what's disturbing about the bonobos is you're like, because they're primates, there's some kind of mirror of ourselves, and they're mirroring something that people both want and can't acknowledge in themselves. So it's not even just repression, it's almost like it's too close. It's too intimate. It's like,
right.
It's like it reminds us of our animality, and at the same time seems to present a utopia that most people don't even want to acknowledge that they have in their heads as a utopia. So it's a really weird mirror, and it was funny to watch in the, you know, I've been in San Francisco in the 90s as well, and I probably know similar kind of people that were in your office and people who were sex positive and really, you know, are thinking about things in a different way. And there was a point where the bonobos became kind of like, you know, like underground stars. They were like badges of identity, and people would talk about them, and there's an electronic music act called Bonobo.
Yeah,
and it's like,
sure.
You know, it's like there's this sense of like, hey, there's another world possible through these creatures. But then what that led you to go is, well, what about us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. And the thing is, I just gave a TED talk. I guess you saw one that I gave in Vancouver a while ago, and I just gave a talk 2 weeks ago at the big show here in Long Beach.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah, so that'll be posted pretty soon. But in that talk, I try to show how, you know, humans are equally, in terms of DNA, we're equally related to chimps and bonobos. But in terms of our sexual behavior, we're much more like bonobos than we are like chimps. You know, in the sense that we have sex face to face, that we have sex throughout the female's menstrual cycle, whereas chimps, it's reduced to about 40% of her menstrual cycle. You know, there's kissing and holding hands, and, you know, it's just, the list goes on and on and on. And so, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. If people take a close look at bonobos, it can be very embarrassing if they've got a lot invested in denying their own sexuality.
Yeah, and it also seemed like it's a great example of the way in which you can have, you know, you can build this whole, you know, scholarly, scientific, naturalistic argument about monogamy in human populations by looking at the chimpanzee, and you go, okay, well, okay, if that's the model, well, let's figure out a reason or an explanation, and so we come up with a story about trading, you know, goods for protection and paternity and the standard model you talk about, because let's just shift, you know, the scientific object to something different, another creature, and then this other kind of, it's almost like it allows you to be politically critical of the whole apparatus that's used to generally justify monogamy. It's like the bonobo lets you go into like this other way of looking at things from which you could go. You get in your book in Sex at Dawn this radically different vision of what human sexuality was like in its, you know, primary evolutionary psychologically fit a period of time.
Yeah, and it's even, you're right, that the bonobo offers that opportunity, but I think it's even stronger than that because the chimp offers the same opportunity pretty much. There is that reduction in the amount of the menstrual cycle where the female is sexually active, but during that 40%, females have sex 1 to 4 times a day with a dozen partners per day. So they're certainly not sexually monogamous, right? And the males are certainly not assuring paternity in any way. To look for a primate model of monogamy, you've got to go to the gibbon, which is the only ape that is even nominally monogamous, and even they're not. DNA testing has shown that they're not particularly sexually monogamous, although they are socially monogamous.
Right.
So they live together in pairs, but the female's off having sex with other males.
Well, you use, I think one of the images you use to argue your point in the book, in the TED Talk, that's, you know, probably also worth talking about here, is just the whole comparison of penis and testicle size, looking at the different primates and the different kinds of behaviors they have, and then comparing them to humans. It seems to me like a pretty solid argument.
yeah, it's true. The human, well, any body can be read by a biologist, right? And it makes sense if you find an animal and it's got a thick layer of fat, subcutaneous fat, and it's got webbed feet. Well, you say, okay, that's obviously an animal that evolved in a cold aquatic environment. You know, it's sort of, there are these obvious signs. And the same is true of our reproductive system. So, for example, if an animal has external testicles, that is a very strong indication that species evolved in the presence of what scientists call sperm competition, because the external testicles keep the sperm cells a little cooler than the body temperature, which allows them to be preserved longer. And so this is a species that is where there's evolutionary pressure on the reproductive system, right? And the same thing with penis design. There are all sorts of interesting penis designs throughout the animal kingdom that indicate sperm competition as well. So the human male body, we've got the external testicles, we've got, you know, we produce a typical male ejaculate has between 100 million and 300 million sperm cells, right? Talk about overkill, right? That's way more than you need. And the shape of the penis with the flared head and the repeated thrusting action that's characteristic of human sexuality, of human intercourse, creates a vacuum in the female's reproductive tract that pulls back pre-existing sperm from other men. So, you know, that's a very clear indication that our female ancestors were not having sex with just one man per menstrual cycle, because the male body evolved to deal with this kind of competition. And then you've got, you know, non-genital stuff, like just the body size difference between males and females is another indication of the sort of mating system of our ancestors.
Well, so that when you lay this material out, you know, in your book over a number of chapters, it's a very cogent argument. And one of the questions that I have that again gets to a little bit more of this sort of political or ideological problem is like, why, you know, you were discovering these, putting these pieces together, you know, tying together obscure bits of research against this dominant model, when people have been thinking and dealing with this stuff for, you know, generations of scholars. So how, as you started to really dive into the material and see what different primatologists and different anthropologists and different kinds of arguments people were making based on these ideas, which were in some ways specious, how did you start to, like, what did that teach you about how science works and how we come up with ideas about what's natural for human beings? And I mean, it must have been really kind of revelatory about just this whole process whereby we look at nature in order to create better stories to explain ourselves.
Yeah, you're right. This whole thing has been like living some sort of surreal dream, because when I first started pulling on this thread back in the 90s when I was in graduate school and thinking about stuff, you know, the first thing I thought was, I can't possibly be right, because if I were right, someone else would have written this book a long time ago. I'm going to keep doing it till I figure out why I'm wrong, you know? And so I kept going and getting more and more excited by it, but also getting more and more concerned that, wow, you know, I'm building this huge argument here that goes against the, you know, the sort of conventional wisdom. And if I'm right, this is really sort of revolutionary, but I'm probably wrong, and I'm probably just going to get humiliated by making this argument publicly. But, you know, the more I invested, I worked on it for over 10 years before I was comfortable writing a book about it, because I needed to really look at it from so many different angles, you know. And, but yeah, you're right. It does say something very important about certain, you know, I think physics is, you know, the hard sciences are much more closely related to the data, whereas something like evolutionary psychology or arguments about the way, you know, human sexuality evolved and so on tend to get much more influenced by cultural constraints. And even Darwin, I suspect that Darwin really knew some of this stuff, but it was just too much. He had already pushed so many limits in his work and his marriage that I don't think he could really afford to make some of these arguments about human sexuality without ending up completely alone and distraught, because his wife was very conventional and very religious.
Yeah, that was, it's funny how, I mean, one of the things that becomes so interesting about sexuality is the way in which it connects us with our animality in a way different than everything else. I mean, of course, we eat, there's all tons of stuff we do, we're born, we die, there's all these ways we're connected to straight animality, but there's something about that space alone that brings up all of these needs to draw distinctions and fear of identification, and so it would make sense that would be the place where that he would sort of keep under wraps, you know, and also given the nature of his society. But your book's been out a couple of years now. What's been the response by some of the theoreticians and evolutionary psychologists and primatologists and people who work on this material, you know, scholars who work on this material? Have you gotten some good feedback? Have you noticed some shifts in the discourse?
Yeah, to some extent. I think different communities, like among primatologists, the response has been very positive. People like Franz Duval, who I mentioned earlier, or Sarah Hurdy, who's a very well-known primatologist/anthropologist, who's written wonderful books about alloparenting. People like that have contacted us, and Franz Duval provided a blurb for the book, even though we disagree with some of his conclusions. But yeah, we've been very well received by the people in that kind of area. And also people who work in couples therapy, Esther Perel, whom you mentioned in your introduction, which was excellent, by the way. I'd love to get back to some of those points you made. People like that have been very supportive. The book has won a couple of awards from a Society for Scientific Investigation of Sexuality and Therapy organizations. So it's been very positive from those people. The evolutionary psychology crowd, I would say, is not positive. They've been quite negative and vociferous in some cases in dismissing the book out of hand.
Well, what do you think that has to do? Not so much with the arguments, because one of the things about evolutionary psychology is they just love these kinds of arguments, whether they're taking an economic metaphor or whatever, and they're very, you know, they want to build something that's like, you know, airtight, you know, that's all about these sort of airtight claims. And you're like, well, okay, that seems good, but you can build other ones. There's the sort of just-so story problem that people talk about, where it's like they work in reverse because they want to get somewhere in particular, and that's sort of based on how they see the model in the first place. But just in terms of a kind of, since it's such an important dialogue right now, I mean, where a lot of people, you know, across the board, scholars, ordinary people, whatever, are remaking their ideas about themselves to some degree as evolutionary psychology filters through you know, mainstream ideas. Has this given you some insight into how that particular world works in terms of how they were responding to your arguments?
Well, I think evolutionary psychology, sometimes I'm described as an evolutionary psychologist, which must drive real evolutionary psychologists crazy because, you know, they don't like me generally or don't like the argument that we've made. I think that there is definitely a legitimate methodology of looking at our evolution and evolutionary pressures and hunter-gatherer societies and primates and all that to try to piece together what sort of species we are. So I think there's a deep legitimacy in the endeavor. But I think that the way evolutionary psychology is often practiced is unfortunate because it's highly political, and yet they pretend it isn't.
Correct.
It's politics in the guise of science. So when I read someone like Steven Pinker, I see a very conservative political perspective being presented as science.
Yeah.
And so when you challenge them on scientific argument, the reaction tends to be emotional because you're challenging their emotional, political, psychological stance, and they don't take it as just a scientific argument. So, like, there was a review written by David Barish, who's a well-known evolutionary biologist, in the Chronicles of Higher Education. It started out saying, the first line of the review was, if one more person asks me about this book, Sex at Dawn, I'm going to vomit. No, that is not a reasoned argument. That's an emotional outburst.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so I think, you know, in evolutionary psychology, I think they're doing some sleight of hand there, and they really don't like it if anyone calls them on it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful perspective. Well, this is a great conversation. We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Christopher Ryan about Sex at Dawn and Sex in Our World. So we'll be right back. Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis here on PRN, talking with Christopher Ryan about his book Sex at Dawn. Well, staying with some of this, the kind of political question here, one of the big political dimensions of this debate is the long-standing, highly controversial question of, you know, how fun it was to be alive, to be a human being back in the, you know, Paleolithic times, back when we were hunter-gatherers living in small groups, and whether this was a miserable, nasty, brutish existence, or whether it was actually kind of cool. And, you know, this has gone back a long ways and whatever, but that's a very important dimension to your argument, and some of your book spends a good deal of time looking at this and looking at this kind of what our model is of this time. So again, like, how did you come to see our hunter-gatherer existence the way that you did in the book?
Yeah, you're right. That's an important issue that I'm expanding in the book I'm working on now, which is called Civilized to Death. I'm taking a more broader look at that very question that you raise. It's a complicated question because language leads us to frame it in ways that aren't quite accurate. For example, we often talk about our hunter-gatherer existence as if it were one thing, right? One context or one way of living. Whereas if you look back 100 or 200,000 years, you can see that there were all sorts of climactic changes and, you know, human migrations in different parts of the world. So people were living in different ways in different times. And I think in general, we can say that life was pretty good, and that the Hobbesian vision of you know, every man fighting against every other man, and, you know, the sort of, you know, each to himself vision of nasty, brutish, and short life was not, that's not accurate at all. Mainly because the way our ancestors were able to survive and thrive is through sharing. You know, people think, you know, this vision of a man coming back with, you know, going out and killing a deer or something and then coming back with his deer and sharing the meat only with his woman and their children, you know, as is posited in this standard narrative of human sexual evolution, is absurd when you look at the way hunter-gatherers actually live. If you did that, you'd immediately be ejected from the band and, you know, you'd die alone in the middle of nowhere. In fact, sharing of food, particularly of meat, is the sort of central organizing principle of pre-agricultural societies. Not because they're noble savages, just because that's the best way to mitigate risk in that ecological situation. So we find wherever you look at immediate return hunter-gatherers, which are what our ancestors were, anywhere in the world you find that universal quality of those societies, that food is shared. So that also leads this to be a highly political discussion, even if the scientists pretend it isn't, because that gets into the whole, you know, socialism versus capitalism argument, right?
Absolutely.
So, sorry, go
and
ahead.
It also, yeah, I mean, it also, one dimension of it that was really a really profound shift that I went through after reading your book and thinking about it was that, you know, like, so let's just take the bonobos again. So they're having all this sex all the time. Well, what's a good, you know, a grounded evolutionary Darwinian explanation for what they're doing? And what you point out is that what they're doing is that they're maintaining, massaging, and, you know, enchanting and juicing up social networks, which are, of course, incredibly important to human beings and human society. It's kind of it's impossible to think about a human individual outside of social networks. And indeed, increasingly with the internet and with, you know, revised models of how humans innovate and how they create change and how they sustain themselves, we're coming to recognize more and more and more just how incredibly woven we are into a rich social life rather than just these sort of individual agents who are just trying to, you know, get and spend on their own. So that seems to be another really political dimension, is to encourage us or invite us to think about sexuality in our own lives and just in our society, not just as a pursuit of pleasure or an avenue towards a family or an avenue towards reproduction, but actually always already part of the way in which we sustain ourselves and move through social communities. And that really changes the big picture about what our sexuality is about.
Yeah, you're right. That's a profoundly political statement, but I think it's undeniable. If you look, for example, at gorillas, which are the next closest relation to humans after the chimps and the bonobos, a gorilla has sex about 12 times for each baby gorilla that's conceived. Right? The ratio of sex act to birth is about 12 to 1. For humans, it's about 1,000 to 1, and bonobos as well. For chimps, it's closer to 500-600 to 1. Right? So, obviously, human sexuality and bonobo and chimp sexuality is not primarily about reproduction. If it were, our ratio would be down around 10, 15 to 1, as it is for gorillas and mammals typically. The fact that we have so much sexual activity in our lives, you know, beyond what is needed for reproduction, makes it clear that, as you say, our sexuality has a profoundly social function in our species, and in bonobos and chimps and in dolphins, all of which are highly intelligent, highly social beings. So, yeah, you're right. It's not about, and this is the big lie at the center of the standard narrative of human sexuality, that sex is about reproduction. And that's why, you know, and you can see it playing out in the political realm today in talking about, you know, gay marriage. Well, no, gay marriage can't possibly be acceptable because they can't have babies. Well, it's not about having babies. It's about forming relationships. And once you understand that, then this whole argument over gay marriage becomes ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's take this a little bit farther in terms of, and there's, I have kind of a two-part question that partly refers back to my introduction, which is about the sort of, you know, role as a sex expert. And I, you know, you must have been, and you know, at the close of your book, you sort of suggest some problems and some possibilities that at the very least we need to take your model seriously, or should take it seriously enough, as a way to help explain and understand the, you know, profound confusions and challenges and difficulty and suffering that so many people go through in terms of, you know, their sexual life. So there's this kind of pressure, and there, you know, probably even a commercial pressure to some degree of like, oh, hey, Christopher, what's the answer? You know, like, what do we do to get out of here? But it seems like a good first step towards something like that, and I would like to hear you just reflect on that general pressure as well, and maybe how you're working with it in your current, you know, the various things that you're doing now. But it seems like the beginning of a good answer has to do with that shift in terms of recognizing the central role of social relationships in maintaining and how people maintain their kind of social worlds.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The commercial pressure started before the book was even written. When we were pitching it to publishers, a lot of publishers said, okay, love the idea here, but there's got to be, you know, 10 steps to whatever, you know, to the perfect marriage, or it's got to be prescriptive. And when I said, no, it's not going to be prescriptive, you know, I don't want to write that kind of book, you know, we lost two-thirds of the publishers who were interested in publishing the book. So you're absolutely right. That pressure's there from the beginning. But, you know, Casilda and I felt, Casilda's a psychiatrist and has worked with all sorts of different people, and we both felt that you can't give advice to people you don't know. And, you know, even if you do know them, you probably shouldn't be giving them advice. It's a very delicate thing. So neither of us were interested in writing a book that was prescriptive. But there was the pressure from our editor and to do something at the end, you know, some application of these ideas. So we just sort of tacked on a story about a friend of ours who was going through a nasty divorce at the time and, you know, like showed, okay, here's how these ideas play out in someone's life, and sort of a typical case. But I almost wish we hadn't done that, because that's the one part of the book that some readers don't like as much, because it feels incomplete to them, or, you know, they have for various reasons. But, you know, you made the point in your introduction, which was excellent, talking about how it's one thing to diagnose and describe an issue, and it's another thing to offer solutions. And, you know, sometimes a doctor can diagnose a disease for which there is no known cure. Yeah, but that doesn't mean the diagnosis is illegitimate or wrong. And so I feel like in our case, we're pointing to an issue, we're pointing to a deep conflict between modern society and some of our evolved tendencies, and we're saying, look, this is why the passion in your marriage may have faded. It doesn't mean you've got a bad marriage. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you or your partner. It just means, you know, this is the kind of animal we are, and you put us in that situation, and there's going to be trauma. There's going to be suffering. So I hope we're offering people a framework for understanding that leads to more compassion and maybe some more flexibility in the way we arrange things, and more understanding of and acceptance of same-sex marriage or polyamorous situations. But we're not offering any specific solution.
Yeah, well, I admire you for taking that stand. I mean, it seems like one of the you know, the whole problem with expertise and solutions and prescriptions isn't just that they don't often work or it becomes just sort of a commercial thing, but it you know, relieves people of the opportunity to recognize that you really have to kind of move intimately into the problem. You really have to go into the problem without a sense of judgment or wrongness, but recognize it as a problem that we're in modern life, there's all these things that are not resolvable. Doesn't mean that it's hopeless, but it means that it opens up different possibilities. So, you know, for example, I'm very interested in polyamory. It seems like one of the more kind of radical social spaces, but also very ordinary in some ways that people are developing in light of this enormous, widespread sort of social mythology about monogamy. Not that people can't have wonderful monogamous relationships or that polyamory is better, it's just different. And it's interesting, though, because so many people are like, you know, immediately they'll jump to the problems. And like, oh, that's not going to work, or the men are going to exploit it, or this or that, da-da-da. And you're like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's true. That's a problem. That's going to come up. Yes, for sure. But the whole thing is a problem. Like, there's no way out of the problem, you know? And it's, so once you see that there's no way out of the problem, then it's like, well, then different frameworks, you know, take on different characteristics, which I guess is my way of kind of running up to ask you, in writing the book, and since then, as you've looked, I'm going to assume that you've been interested in these other kinds of, approaches to the problem, particularly polyamory. I'm kind of curious to hear how you reflect on how you see that whole kind of, there's many different approaches, many different styles, different languages, but in general, how you've come to perceive contemporary polyamory in terms of its engagement with these issues, some of its blind spots, what seems useful and productive, how it's going forward.
Yeah, I think polyamory is an important and growing movement, if we can call it a movement, certainly a community of polyamorous people, because, you know, the polyamorous like to say we do what everyone else does, we just don't lie about it. You know, and I think there's a lot of value in an open dialogue, and it doesn't even mean that you necessarily have to live in that way, but being open to discussing it and being open to the fact that it is the better way for some people and that it's not necessarily a problem for kids and that jealousy sometimes can be worked through and overcome. And, you know, just having that as a viable, legitimate option, I think, is very important. And again, I don't think it's necessarily the answer for everyone, but, you know, hey, monogamy, you know, I sometimes get into these discussions with people and they say, you know, oh, that'll never work, you know, or people get jealous, people have problems, and they just, as you said, they just dismiss it out of hand. But the assumption seems to be that monogamy works great. And, you know, look around, you know, if 50% of our airplanes were falling out of the sky, don't you think somebody would be looking to redesign airplanes, you know? So, you know, I've given a lot of public presentations, and the crowds that show up for these presentations are fantastic. And to the point where I started to realize that people come to my presentations not so much to hear me, but to meet each other, you know,
right.
Because they know that it's going to be a crowd full of smart, open-minded, sexy people. So we decided to set up a website where these people could get together and talk about these issues. It's called Kotango, KOTANGO.com. And it's still in beta testing, but it's just a community site for people interested in ethical non-monogamy. So you're not cheating. It's not, you know, Ashley Madison where you can go and, you know, cheat on your spouse. It's a place where you can just talk about these things, whether you want to live it or not, you know?
Yeah. Well, one aspect of it that I think that just popped in my head as you were talking was just the whole issue of jealousy. And it's interesting, I mean, when you talk about this, you know, your longstanding fascination for where can we talk about you know, the human animal and this evolutionary body versus culture and how culture operates. And, of course, our emotions are things that we generally experience as being, you know, natural. They just happen spontaneously. This is just how I feel. You know, there's a reason for it. I'm angry because, you know, I want to get something. I'm sad because I've lost something. This is really basic, kind of hardwired stuff. But, of course, it's more complicated than that. And a lot of emotions, in some sense, all of them have their different cultural expressions. Different cultures deal with them in different ways. And jealousy, to my mind, has always been one that's particularly complicated in the way in which what is, you know, what can be experienced is very much a part of a cultural response, but people tend to naturalize it as being like, this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, this is just hardwired. I'm feeling this way because, you know, this is how, you know, nature made me, and there's no giving on that feeling. There's something like almost like supreme about the feeling of jealousy as it comes up, or is one of the most interesting things that come through you know, polyamory discussions in terms of psychology, is a very different framework for how to think about, work through, analyze, break down, reformulate what jealousy is. And so I'm curious, as you're looking at things, whether or not through the evolutionary psychology mirror, how you've come to think about, you know, one of the main issues that people would bring up in regards to ethical non-monogamy is this enormous jealousy monster.
Yeah. I think that, like most human behaviors, jealousy has some very deep instinctive component and, as you say, very important cultural overlay. So, you know, in the sense that jealousy is an expression of insecurity, then that's obviously instinctive. But, you know, it's interesting that we don't get jealous of the fact that our friends have other friends. And we don't think that a woman who has three kids loves each of them a third as much as the woman who has one kid. Right, so we don't see love in zero-sum terms, except for our sexual partners, and we're not jealous of other people's ongoing overlapping relationships, except for, you know, the sexual partner. So it seems incongruous in many ways, and when you look around the world at different societies, you find that some societies dampen down the sexual jealousy and the possessiveness of sexual partners, whereas other societies tend to celebrate them and ramp them up. And that's our society. You know, we've got all these songs, you know, baby, you're the only one. And, you know, when a man loves a woman, he'll spend his last dime and sleep out in the rain and, you know, all this kind of ridiculousness, celebrating this very childish notion of what love is. And I think it leads us down the wrong road. So many people don't understand the deep, profound differences between love and sexual attraction, for example. You know, and they get together and feel like, oh, this infatuation, that's love. Well, no, that's not love. That's a wonderful feeling, but that's a feeling that's only going to last for a while. And then you're going to be left with the person behind that feeling who you can't even see right now because you're so, you know, drunk with attraction.
Apes on drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Love is the drug. So, yeah, I've forgotten your question. I got distracted.
No, you were answering. We were just talking about jealousy and how
jealousy,
it,
right,
you know, can kind of be reframed. Well, we're gonna wrap it up pretty soon here. We got about 5 more minutes, and I'm kind of curious to if you want to talk a little bit about your current book, Civilized to Death, because as mentioned, there's a lot of ways to read Sex at Dawn, not just about this issue, but as an engagement with some of these, you know, basic political questions about what kind of societies work for us, where we've been, what are the possibilities, and so I'm kind of curious about what's some of the questions you're looking at there that spill out of your Sex at Dawn research.
Yeah, it's You know, there's this central section in Sex at Dawn that really doesn't have much to do with sexuality. It's more just about the way people lived in many of these hunter-gatherer societies. So we talk about economics and longevity and, you know, basic health issues and things like that, some political discussion. And I really wanted to expand that into a full book. So that's sort of what we're doing in this book. I'm not sure, you know, I'm working on it now, so I'm not sure exactly how it's going to play out. But the sort of germ of it was a comedian named Louis C.K., which you probably know, a lot of your listeners will know. He was doing a bit on a talk show one night, and he was talking about how he was on an airplane and there was Wi-Fi on the airplane. And he said, like, this is the newest thing. This is the latest, most amazing thing. You're in an airplane, you know, checking your email. It's just incredible. And then something went wrong and the stewardess came on and said, oh, we're going to have to reset the Wi-Fi. Sorry, it'll be a few minutes. And the guy next to him said, oh, this is bull. This sucks. And he said, wow, you know, it took like 5 minutes before you got completely, you expected this thing, you know, and now you're unhappy when it cuts off. So the tagline was, he said, these days everything's amazing, but nobody's happy.
Yeah.
And that's the germ of this book. And I'll probably start, you know, quoting him with that line. And so I wanted to think, like, why is that? Why is it that, you know, we're in this time of incredible progress, in scare quotes, and yet, you know, the best-selling pharmaceuticals in the world are antidepressants. You know,
yeah.
There's something really wrong here. So the argument I'm making is essentially that the trajectory of Western civilization is drawing us ever further away from the things that make life enjoyable and fulfilling and meaningful. And so, you know, we're always told this latest technological development is going to give us more free time and more, you know, family fun and more, but it always seems like we have less and less and less. And I think we're at a moment now where, well, there's a line from Arthur Miller, the playwright, where he says, an era can be considered over when its basic illusions have been exhausted. Yeah, and I think we're in that moment. I think we're in a tipping point where, for maybe the first time in 100 years or more, people in Western societies are saying, this doesn't work, and it's not going to work. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. And so they're looking around for alternative understandings of sexuality, but of other things as well. And so that's what I'm trying to get at in this next book.
Well, that's wonderful. Best of luck with that. We got to wrap it up here, but I'm also always interested in the great question of when you have a positive view of hunter-gatherer civilization, and when you recognize that in many ways agriculture was nasty and brutish, if not short. There's always that great question of, like, why did we do that? You know, why did people stick around for that? But anyway, that's just we'll have to leave that one hanging, but I really look forward to hearing your further thoughts on that. Is there any place where you want to suggest any URL or places people can look at what you're doing now?
Sure. I've got chrisryanphd.com is sort of a site for just me, and then there's sexatdawn.com if they want to read excerpts from the book or reviews or whatever. And then you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Ryan, PhD.
Awesome. All right, Chris, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
I really enjoyed it. Excellent interview. Thanks.
Great, great. All right, folks, from me here at Expanding Mind, PRN, keep your minds open.